out of all the discussions that we have so far had, I think a slight insight into what the yogis call truth and falsehood emerges. The lake or cosmic indivisible intelligence is true. It is cosmic, indivisible, and it is consciousness, intelligence. That is true. If you compare it to the lake is true. With all its ripples, with all its currents, and with all its waves, and yet without these distinctions. The wave doesn't come and say, I am the wave. The ripple doesn't come and say, I am a ripple. It's only because we are outside it, we name them, we call them, we distinguish them one from the other. The totality is truth. It does not mean that the totality has to abolish, has to be free of the waves and the ripples. So that it does not mean that all of us must cease to exist, commit suicide before self-knowledge can be attained. Deep within this ripple there is the same lake. Why do I say within the ripple? Because something has to be said. And when they said the self is in the heart, it does not mean this heart, the flesh, the heart that is flesh, but the definition of the Yoga Vasishtha, the heart is the consciousness in that body. And where is the consciousness in that body? There is nothing but consciousness in that body. You see it as gross flesh only because you are seeing with the fleshy eyes. The fleshy eyes are capable of seeing only flesh. The eyes that are flesh can see only flesh. The mind that is, if you squeeze your eyes like that, and the mind that is thought can see it as only a thought. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Are we more or less jumping off together? Mm-hmm. Eyes are flesh, so you see this as flesh. The mind is thought and it sees it as a concept, as a notion, as a personality, as a donkey. As is a donkey, right? Right. When even that is dropped, and where you, on the plane of consciousness, consciousness becomes conscious of consciousness. Uh-huh. It is not I see consciousness. Consciousness becomes conscious of consciousness. So to say, why is it I see the differences? The I sees the differences. Because the I being flesh sees only flesh. The mind being thought sees only thoughts, notions, concepts. Man, woman, all these concepts. Blonde hair, red hair. That is what the eye is tuned to. When the mind sees this, the mind sees all these as different concepts. Again. A beautiful girl, a strong man. That is what the mind is tuned to. All these are all the time true, but the truth is not conceptual, not divisible. All these are true on their own planes, and all these exist without any division whatsoever. Lake is true, waves are true, so ripples are true. But that the ripples or the waves are independently true is false. Perhaps you are wondering, why on earth do we then say false? Nothing seems to be false. That is it. Nothing is false. False is nothing. Because what is false cannot exist. Krishna said it in a very beautiful couplet in the Gita in the second chapter. The unreal cannot be, and the real cannot cease to be. Not just one couplet, and he quietly dropped it in the Gita and kept quiet. It's difficult to, and it has been commented on. So that we are hanging on to the false, even in our attempt to get rid of the false, you are making the false appear to be real. So, the attention is to what is true, what is real. To come back to this, to the I mind. In the same way we saw yesterday, that a so-called sensation of pleasure creates attachment in the mind. You become attached, What else do we say? You understand the difficulty? I want to say you get attached to the pleasure sensation, and so the object that from which you think the pleasure sensation comes to you. It's not true. That is not the truth. The truth is the pleasure sensation itself becomes attachment at the other side. There is this intelligence everywhere, in every cell of this body. And that seems to be nice. What says that? The intelligence in the fingertips. And the intelligence in the fingertips, which experiences this pleasure, seeks that pleasure. Goes round. It approves that as pleasure. Seeks that pleasure, experiences that pleasure, approves that pleasure, seeks it, goes on. What has I got to do with this? To put it crudely again, just for understanding, don't take it too far. Yeah, I think all of us have experienced this. At least some, most of us. Chocolate is nice, was it? Yeah, right. Put it on the tongue. Chocolate tastes delightful. That. You buy a bar of chocolate and keep it inside the car when the sun is hot. It starts melting. Have you ever taken that to pieces so carefully that it doesn't stick to your hands and soil and spoil your hand, and then do it like that? Yeah? Why? The sweetness of the chocolate can be enjoyed only by the tongue, not by your palm. If that chocolate comes on the palm, you feel it is dirty, you'd want a tissue and wipe it as though it's filth and throw it away. And yet the tongue loves it. I think all of us have experienced chocolate, ice cream, these two. You love to taste ice cream, but you don't want it on your dress, you don't want it on your skin, you don't want it on your hand, it's sticky, it's funny. So wrap it up in half a dozen tissues and lick it, but the tongue loves it. It doesn't say it is dirty. That's it. The tongue loves chocolate, but the hand says no, palm says no, it's dirty. I don't want to dirty myself with the chocolate. Luckily, the palm doesn't say so to the tongue, otherwise the tongue will cut the palm off. You call my sweet chocolate dirty, filthy? So, the hand keeps quiet. It's good to remember this. So, when you see something not so desirable somewhere, don't keep quiet, don't say it. It is desirable to so-and-so one, why bother about that? Right? The tongue loves chocolate, the hand sees it. And says, okay, you carry on, as long as you don't stick on to me, you stick on to the tongue, go on, carry on. If you see something that is that you don't approve of, keep it. That's the lesson the hand teaches me. And now, we are on another track. The tongue and the chocolate have a natural affinity with each other. The hand and the chocolate do not have that natural affinity. So there is a tongue-chocolate interaction. The tongue likes it, the chocolate gets into the tongue. The tongue likes it, the chocolate gets into the tongue. The tongue feels it sweet and appreciates it sweet, enjoys it sweet, longs for that sweet. Now you must get into that a little more. The tongue enjoys, there is sweetness, and the sweetness creates a longing. And the longing brings the chocolate again, it enjoys, that's it. This attraction is based upon the experience of pleasure, which means pleasure and attraction form a cycle. Pleasure seeks enjoyment, and the enjoyment is an attraction. There is an attraction, it goes on. Right? That's a complete cycle in itself. In the same way, pain, the sense of pain, the feeling of pain rejects, and the rejection becomes painful, pain rejects and rejection becomes painful, that's another cycle. It goes on. Just one step more, you see it immediately. You are expecting something to happen, and if it does not happen, you are frustrated. Is that right? I don't know. I don't know if that is right. I don't know if that is truth. Am I frustrated when something which was expected did not happen? If I am frustrated, that frustration should not leave me at all. I am a man. Yesterday I was a man, today I am a man, day after tomorrow I will still be a man. Not changing. I am a human being, I won't change into a dog next year. I am a human being. In the same way, if I say I am frustrated, this frustration, I am stuck with this frustration forever. That's not true. Why? Because it was the expectation that got frustrated. Expectation is followed by frustration. Frustration leads to expectation. It goes on and on and on and on and on. That's the whirlpool again. That goes on and on. But here, Patanjali asks us, what have you got to do with this? What has I got to do with this? Expectation becomes frustrated. Hope leads to disappointment. Pursuit of pleasure leads to pain or craving. And the craving is sooner or later realized to be pain. In all this drama, what has you got to do with it? This was the inquiry we discussed a couple of days ago. That is called abhyasa. And only if this is clearly realized, the abhyasa that is of eight limbs becomes also clear. The eight limbs of yoga become clear only if this, the basic framework, the philosophy, becomes absolutely clear. Because those eight limbs are merely an elaboration of the basis of the philosophy, the realization of this philosophy. Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. These are the eight limbs. Limbs, not yoga, yoga, ashtavangani. These are the eight limbs of yoga, not eight steps. So, some great masters have considered them eight steps. But they are eight limbs. It is good to have had the darshan of this little baby this morning. You saw that little baby had all the limbs in time already. It cannot run like some of you. It cannot talk like me. It cannot read like you. Think like you. We don't know what it thinks. But the baby is there. The total man is there already. Probably undeveloped, physically at least, probably not developed, not fully developed. But all the limbs are there already. That baby is not going to develop something other than what it has now. It will grow bigger, larger, and at one stage probably it may also become a problem. It's going too large. And join a yoga class to see slim. All that is possible. But the total baby is there now, today. I mean, two weeks ago. And therefore, one who practices yoga, one who understands the philosophy of yoga, as he steps on to the path, he is fully there. All the eight limbs are to be practiced every moment. Not one after the other. Yama. What are yama? Yama is a funny word. Yama means restraint. Yama means a sort of terminus. Thus far and no further. Also, Yama is the name of the deity presiding over death. Someone who says, enough. I give you enough chance to try something. Well, enough. Next time. You have played enough mischief, you have played. you have done enough. Marvelous, marvelous, wonderful chap. Now, that's enough. Start again. See if you can do something better. And that deity of death is also called Yama. It's important to remember that. Yama is a termination. It is complete and total. And Patanjali gives us a list of Yama. I've often said this, I hope you remember, that it is not as though there is it's a sort of a commandment. It's more a description. There's no commandment at all. Even when Patanjali suggests that these are Sarvabhauma Mahavratam, these are universal in their application, there is no suggestion there that thou shalt. If you are truly and sincerely and seriously practicing yoga, these will be found in you. And these are not amendable. It does not apply here, it applies to India, it applies to China. These are universal principles. Universal qualities which are universally found in all serious practitioners of yoga. If they are not found in you, never despair, it's all right. As you go on practicing yoga, they will come. Does yoga have a goal? We will come to that little later. So that, I don't know when perfection has been reached. It is when perfection has been reached, all these qualities are found in their perfection, in that man, in that person, in that yogi. Right? Baby is there, small tiny limbs. And as the baby grows to a perfect manhood, all the limbs also reach their own perfection at that point. These two again are two sides of the same coin. It is not as though that after he has developed all his limbs to perfection, suddenly he says, all right, now that I have strong legs and mighty arms and a lovely beard, I'll go and find if I can become a man tomorrow. It is then that manhood has already happened together with that. It's not one after the other, it's all at the same time, simultaneous. These qualities are not commandments, but descriptions of what are found in yogis. Ahimsa satyam asteya brahmacharya aparigraha yamaha. Ahimsa. Ahimsa is non-violence. And most commentators, including our master Swami Shivananda, emphasize that it is love, it's not merely non-violence or non-aggressiveness, but it is love. But that love is not the type of love that we practice. I love you, you love me, that sort of thing. It is love in which the least trace of violence is absent. So you take care of aggression. You take care of violence in all its aspects. See that those things do not exist. You cannot bring, or you need not bring love into being, it is there already. When you do not see sun, it does not mean that sun has somehow disappeared and you have to bring that sun into being. There is a cloud, blow that cloud away, the sun is already there. When that cloud is blown away, you see the sun has always been shining there. Love is always there in the heart. The ultimate reality being oneness, the manifestation of that oneness is love. Love is merely the manifestation of the oneness that is already there. I am not going to create it. That is somehow veiled by the spirit of domination, aggression, violence. Blow that out. You will see that love is there, has always been there. That is ahimsa. And therefore, the description has been given in negative terms, ahimsa, non-violence. Where in the Bhakti Yoga sutras, where love was described rather positively, sattvaspin parama prema rupa, there also the author, having qualified it by saying this is supreme love. Bhakti is not the ordinary kind of sensuous love, it is supreme. I suppose you realize that the word supreme already creates a negativeness. not this, not this, not this, not this supreme. And again, to emphasize that factor, Narada went on to describe that this is mukasvadanavati, indescribable. Anirvachaniyam prema surupam. It's not possible to describe it at all. Instead of going to all that length, Patanjali adopts a very simple method. Describe it negatively already. Ahimsa. Satyam. Satyam is truthfulness. I'm afraid I'm wrong. Sorry. Satyam means truth. What is truth as a discipline? Non-violence as a discipline, I guess some people know. What is truth as a discipline? Saying what is true? Do I know what is true? It's a lovely passage in the Bible. Somebody asked Jesus, what is truth? And he kept going and walked away. What is truth? Can your mind grasp this truth and describe it? What is described, is it a description or the truth? Can you ever describe anything truthfully? Anything at all. What is truth as a discipline? Non-violence as a discipline, I guess some people know. What is truth as a discipline? Saying what is true? Do I know what is true? It's a lovely passage in the Bible. Somebody asked Jesus, what is truth? And he kept going and walked away. What is truth? Can your mind grasp this truth and describe it? What is described, is it a description or the truth? Can you ever describe anything truthfully? Anything at all. You call this a lake? I may not. I may call it something else. Once we were driving towards the seaside in Mauritius, we were going to the beach. One little boy was in the car, little one, 2 years old. He jumped up and we were all looking at the sea. And someone said, La mer, the sea. There is no la mer, it's only water. Why do you call it ocean? It's water. What is called the ocean? Ocean is only a word which occurs in your mind. It's just water. So, what is truth? Do I know how to sift truth from opinion? Someone in Australia once sort of tried to tackle me. She was a very wealthy woman. She had an ashram property and so on. She wanted to invite Swami so-and-so from India to come and take charge. And she asked me, do you know Swami so-and-so? I said, yes. Tell me something. Is he all that great? And I said, madam, do you want my opinion or my truth or the truth? Do you want the truth or do you want my opinion? Of course I want the truth, you know. She's a very big lady. She could compromise. Of course I want the truth. He said, sorry, I don't know. Ah, what's your opinion? That's my opinion, not for you. That's my private business. Why should you pry into my secrets? I may have my own opinion. That's for me, not for you. It's my opinion. What is truth? I don't know. What is my opinion? It's my business. Is it possible at all to sift the wheat from the chaff? If you do that, then you probably come back to this magnificent truth that there is only one, the rest being opinion. The rest being appearance. Appearance being what appears to my eyes, what appears to my mind, to thought. Truth really means that. Not merely speaking the truth. Continuous, persistent quest of what is. Not trying to read your own opinions into what is called truth. And calling it truth. It's a ridiculous thing. Now you see those two are closely interrelated. Ahimsa, non-violence or love, and truth, they are closely interconnected. The moment the heart sees the truth, realizes the truth of oneness, there is love. Obviously, you don't have to struggle. The same thing is true of what is called Brahmacharya. Brahmacharya, not only in the sense of continence, but in the sense of the mind constantly moving in it, towards it, flowing towards it, moving in it. Brahmacharya literally means to live, move and have one's being in that truth, Brahman, in the cosmic unity, cosmic being. Can the mind constantly, can the heart constantly move in that being, live in that being? Then naturally ahimsa is inevitable and satyam is inevitable. Asteya and aparigraha seem to be nearly an anticlimax in this context, unless we realize that they probably had a different connotation, non-stealing and non-greediness. Non-stealing and non-greediness, why do I steal at all? Why do I covet somebody else's property and things like that? It is when there is a sense of division. So here there is a sort of indication of positive oneness, and there what happens when a mental division arises? Selfishness. They were indicative of selfishness. Don't hold. And asteya, non-stealing. We don't always steal, but we all, but we are all thieves. The definition, according to the definition of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, "What nature gives you, plenty, and freely. If you enjoy without sharing with others, you are a thief." Tair dattan apradayebhyo yo bhunte stene eva saha. He who enjoys nature's gifts without sharing with others who are in need of it, is a thief. That way I think most of us, most people in the world are thieves. Once the cosmic oneness is realized, then there is no need to hoard. There is no anxiety. And the same thing is reoccurred in the last, which is called aparigraha. Aparigraha means non-acceptance of what one does not need. Non-acceptance of what one does not need. Then there are the five niyamas. Niyamas are more observances. A day-to-day guidelines for living. Shaucha, santosha, tapas, svadhyaya, ishara, pranidhana. Shaucha is cleanliness, purity, cleanliness or purity of mind, purity of dress, purity of body, purity of surroundings. If these things are there, then you may reasonably expect the mind also to be clean. I see this dress, this piece of cloth covering the body. When I am careless about even the cloth which I can see, I see it is dirty and do not mind it, it is unlikely that I will keep what I do not see very clean. I do not see its mind very easily. Now, how am I going to be terribly worried about its uncleanliness when I am not even keen on keeping that clean which I can see clearly? On the other hand, right, having said that, one must also add that there have been instances of great holy men who are reputed to have been rather uncouth and forbidding in their appearance. In their case, their argument was, or the devotees' argument was, that they were completely above body consciousness, the body didn't matter at all. The surroundings didn't matter at all. There are stories of how a very holy man was filthy. The argument advanced by his own followers is that he was totally beyond body consciousness, and so sometimes he swam in the sewer, etc., etc. And then they also say that in spite of all that, there was an aroma of roses around him. I have not seen many of such type, but I have seen one very holy man who kept everything scrupulously clean, Swami Shivananda, absolutely clean. He had lots and lots of washing every day. Somebody did it. Towels, little towels, and his clothes had to be washed twice a day. It was perfect, absolutely clean. And even his skin, the body, and his rooms, everything was absolutely clean. Swami Satyananda also is relatively perfectly clean, beautiful. There is something inspiring about it. There is something attractive and even inspiring about non-cleanliness also, but one must see that in a different light.